Previously on 24.
San Gabriel Island reactor has just gone critical. Core material is now airborne.
I thought we had more time.
This room rate, the radiation will continue getting stronger and will spill into the atmosphere until the core has exhausted itself.
Son, you've done everything you can. Now get the hell out of there.
Evacuating won't make any difference, sir. We've already been exposed.
Jack has got to find the override before the rest of these reactors go critical.
I know about you and him, and I'm not okay with it.
But you and I aren't together anymore.
I thought we were trying to work things out.
I tried, but you kept putting it off.
What did you say to Paul?
I'm filing for divorce.
Somebody set me up. Thousands of people's lives are at stake. Where are the people who control the override?
Talk to me, Sarah.
I'm not a spy.
Aaron Powell's dead. He was hit by a sniper as soon as we took him into custody.
Did you find anything from him before he was killed?
No, but I managed to get the last 10 calls he made off his cell phone.
He called two numbers repeatedly.
We traced one of them to Marianne Taylor.
You're under arrest. Don't move! Drop the weapon!
Listen carefully, Bearers. Government agents found me. I made a deal.
I don't understand.
You're going to be okay. I'm going to help them stop your father.
You broke my heart.
If you kill me, Mother will tell them everything. If you don't believe me, look outside. They're coming to pick me up.
Drop the gun! You'll hit the boy!
Mom!
That stairwell leads to the basement. He's got nowhere to go but down. Set up a link with CTU now!
If you can't save my son,
get down.
The following takes place between 4 p.m. and 5 p.m.
Hi, I'm Stephen Cronish, one of the writer-producers of 24. And we have Nestor Serrano, who plays Navi Araz.
Thanks for that introduction.
I think one of the things that we've sort of been most gratified about this season is the reaction of the audience to the Araz family story. The idea that we were able to, through Nestor's portrayal, Shor Agdashloo, and the young man who played Beruz, were able to, I think, show a fairly chilling side of what we all suspect is part of modern-day terrorism in the United States, the idea that a family could become entrenched in a neighborhood and still be carrying on this kind of activity.
It's not too different from, like, I went to go see Hotel Rwanda. And one of the really striking things about that was that horrific thing that happened in there happened in middle-class suburbia.
Mm-hmm.
And where much of America lives, and you sit there and you think, well, that could never happen here, but there it is, and you're right. That was an important part of that. It was also kind of like it was fun for me to play because it was kind of like a Middle Eastern Sopranos. You know, everybody's going around, running around on cell phones, trying to find out what's going on, and we're just sitting around the kitchen table thinking, I don't think we like this American kid that Johnny is dating. I think we're gonna bump her off.
This young man did a really great job, I think. He
Jonathan.
Was not didn't have that much experience going into this thing, although he was in House of Sand and Fog. But I think in terms of the day-to-day shooting of a series, he was not that familiar with it. But I think he really gave it a sense of humanity and, you know, his arc coming to the realization that what his family was doing was problematic for him, I think was interesting.
Yeah, he was kind of like the bridge between the terrorists and the rest of the world. They
sure.
Kind of can't really kind of comprehend it.
I'll hold him off as long as I can. I know you will.
And he stepped up. I thought he did a really good job. He really is kind of new in this whole
mm-hmm.
thing.
Mm-hmm. Now, these were not easy scenes for him.
Yeah, Jack, I think we
It's amazing how much, when I first got this gig, people were telling me, man, you are not going to believe how much visibility you're going to get, how much exposure, and it's not only a huge hit to the public, but within the industry. I can't walk into a meeting. I can't walk into an audition. Yesterday, I was walking into something that I'm doing now, and that's all everybody wanted to talk about. 24.
It's been gratifying, I'll tell you that. I think to have been able to sustain this concept, which is not an easy concept to pull off for, you know, the four seasons and hopefully into a fifth and sixth, we feel good about that. This year, our ratings actually have been better than they have been for the three previous. So that's also pretty gratifying.
Now listen, I got an idea. Navi Araz's brother, his evil brother, his twin from Turkey,
mm-hmm.
He is so pissed. Now it's personal. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I see what you're saying. You're angling for next year.
I'm just thinking.
It's
something you might want to, you know, just kind of knock around while you guys are having your bogus little meetings.
Well, if your next series fails, then you're available. So is that the?
It's something like that. My next series. This guy here, he was in the Hat Squad. He was. I can't remember his name. What's his name? Curtis?
Roger Cross.
Roger Cross. Yeah.
He was.
He was the guy. He was the first guy to go, oh my God! You know, after I slap him around or something, and I pull out this card, which was my, you know, my trademark. And he turns around and goes, oh, no, you guys aren't the Hat Squad.
That's right. I forgot about that series. You did that for Steve Cannell.
I sure did, yeah.
And we go back as far as Wise Guy. For Steve Cannell.
Right. Now, what's the time frame on that? Do you remember how long ago that was?
1987.
Damn. You had hair then, I think.
Yeah, yeah. Actually, I think it all started going downhill when we started working together.
That's right. That's when you started losing it.
I don't know if there's a relationship there, but.
But yeah, and then what else did we do? We did Maloney.
For CBS.
Right. There was a little profiler.
Profiler, right.
Been kicking around for a while together. As an actor, this was by far, I'm not just saying this was my favorite television experience that I've ever had. And I've been doing this for 30 years. And it was in large part because of the writing and John Cassar, you know, he directed, I think, 6 of the 10 that I did. And all the other directors, but John in particular, he's just got a really good sense of the show.
Well, he makes the show in many areas when the scripts, you know, may need some help. He usually finds a way to boost them up in the shooting that makes our stuff sometimes look better than it is.
You can get us to the override.
I don't have any names. But I can get them for you.
How?
The whole notion of this family embedded in a neighborhood, in a typical American neighborhood, I think is one of the things that the Muslim community, I think, was particularly upset about that. And I think it's important to stress, and I know we have done this on a couple of PSAs that Kiefer did, that we're certainly not trying to say that every Muslim is a terrorist. It's not true, it's not fair, and that is not our intent. But I think that in the times in which we live, if we had said that this was a family of Swedish terrorists, we would have been laughed off the air. So I think in terms of trying to maintain a semblance of reality, given what people know is out there in the world, this seemed really the only way to go. And I think making it a family has made it more accessible for the audience in general. I think that they have enjoyed seeing the personal side of what is usually portrayed as a very cold, monolithic type of operation.
Yeah, I think that's right. Absolutely. And I just finished doing another show where it was also about terrorism, and it was about nuclear weapons, and it was about, in the original draft, the discussion was about Iranian nuclear weapons.
Mm-hmm.
And they literally, on the next draft, changed it to Indonesians. And it was just because, it was obvious why. They just decided, they didn't want to take any heat. But it's just not the reality of the world that we live in today.
Yeah, I think it is a problem for networks, particularly broadcast networks. The struggle between the reality of the world and concerns about fairness or just hot button issues that could have negative impact on the support of advertisers. I think that's just the reality.
Mm. This is drama, and drama should be, it should move you. And if fear is one of the emotions that it gets from its audience, and that's a good thing. The last thing you want to do is sit down and watch something that doesn't really move you in any way, whether it's like watching a comedy that's not funny. This is what's really striking about this, is that it's out there, it's in the front page every day, and...
Well, I do think that if we had portrayed this story as strictly, old men in robes and stuff like that, it would not have had the impact that the Arras story has had. I think because you have a young kid in here, you have the husband and wife dynamic that... I mean, in a way, husband and wife dynamics transcend the sort of cultural... you're going to get it now.
Mm-hmm.
This moment when your son kills your character was... a moment we spent a lot of time on and had some degree of controversy about with network and studio in terms of just the notion of a boy killing his father. Obviously a traumatic moment for him, but I think dramatically much more satisfying than if Jack had done it. Jack's character would have done anything to avoid killing Navi because Navi theoretically could have been used to garner information about the bigger conspiracy. So we just felt there was no real logical reason for Jack to kill Navi short of absolute self-defense, and that Beru's doing it was sort of the ultimate transformation from a kid who was a willing participant in the early stages of this conspiracy to one who would be pushed to the point because of the events that we had seen in the prior episodes, pushed to the point where he would be willing to take this drastic action.
Thank you.
So this Marianne Taylor claims she has to access the file personally.
Yes, she does.
And do you believe her?
I'm not sure. The polygraph indicates that she's telling...
Kiefer, I met... No, we did a scene prior in the garage where I captured Baruz and hit him in the car and then escaped down to that laundry cellar. But I had met him dozens of times on the set, craft service and catering and all that. And I introduced myself to him dozens of times. And every time I did, he'd go, "Hi, who are you?" And then
I know you're just kidding.
And then the day we actually met in the garage there, I forgot who was, it might have been John. John goes, "Hey, Nestor, have you guys met?" And Kiefer goes, "No, I'm sorry, we haven't." But 20 minutes, anyway. So Kiefer, he's got a lot on his mind. He's taking over the world. And
saving the world.
Saving the world.
It's a tough job.
Yeah. You know, I kind of pride myself on being able to handle myself pretty good. I've done a lot of stunts, and they had a stunt guy there. I mean, you know, when you look at it, it really wasn't all that complicated, but he clocked me in the head once.
Seriously?
Yeah. You know, when he did that thing, the headbutt thing, he actually hit me. But it was just a little kind of love tap. But other than that, it was pretty lightweight. But you know what? I'll tell you this. That guy actually knows what he's doing. I'm not just talking about as an actor. We came in, and I also kind of pride myself on having an idea of what the scene is about, and not only dramatically, but you know, cinematically, and mm-hmm. how it's going to play, and what the audience is really looking for, and all that. And we came in to do the scene at the end, and I remember thinking, well, I know how this should go. And I walked over to the director, and we kind of plotted it really quickly. And then something about it didn't ring right. So I went over to the director, and I said, well, you know what? I think it should be more like this. Because at this point, I gave him the idea. And the director said, you know what? I think you're right. But at that point, we couldn't find Kiefer. He had taken off, right? And so when we came back to actually shoot it, Kiefer said, I don't know who it was who had the idea to do it this way, which of course was me, but he said, but that's not going to work. And he explained to me why it wasn't going to work, and it made perfect sense. I mean, it really did. It wasn't what he was going in a completely different direction that I hadn't seen. He knows the show.
No question. I mean, he knows the scripts. He knows, obviously, he knows his character. And I think 99% of the time when he makes a suggestion, it comes not from the sort of ego-driven side of an actor, but from the knowledge of the character and the bigger view mm-hmm. of what the show is supposed to be.
Right, right. Yeah, that particular moment that I was talking about really had nothing to do with you know, him and me. And it was just about beats. Mm-hmm. And letting things kind of come down a little bit before. Actually, I'm talking about the moment that I got shot. My suggestion was that I was going to come at him again, and he wanted it to be really relaxed, like everything was okay, and everything is going to be fine, and we've got him under control, and then the shot comes.
Well, I think had you come at him, then he would have been forced to do something.
Right.
And it would have taken, I think, and it's figuratively speaking, the gun out of the hands of your son. Mm-hmm. And so I think he, you know, and I think that there was much more value in having Baruz shoot you than Jack. And I think that, that sense that it was all going to work out, at least in terms of taking your character alive mm-hmm. and capitalizing on whatever information we could get was ruined by the kid.
Right. So I really have him to blame for me not going on in the show.
Kiefer?
The kid.
Oh, the kid.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'll give you his address later on.
Actually, I'm going to his little celebration on Thursday. I'll slap him around when I go over there. He's having a little are you going?
I can't. I've got a family thing, but it was very nice.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to it. He's a very sweet kid. He reminds me very, very much, and in every way reminds me of my own son. Same age, same kind of character. Good kid. Obviously, I read these scripts. One of the most exciting things that happened this season was that moment when Tony shows up. I mean, I knew it was coming. But when Tony comes out and he says, you know, when he gets on the phone and says, I got to call the only person I trust. And, you know, I kind of knew where it was going, but I knew that the audience was thinking it had to be Chloe. And all of a sudden, just, it was like, man, it was hot.
You know, I'm curious about something, too. When you approached this character, did you think of it in terms of what you were trying to do as a quote-unquote terrorist? Was that kind of an extension of family? Or in your mind, was the family and the mission not really related?
Well, you know, I'm not sure I really gave that a whole lot of thought in that capacity. I mean, I think if I was pressed to answer that, I would have to say that the mission was primary over my family's and the concerns and all that stuff. Is that what you mean?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think that you know, did you feel like this character viewed the mission as some sort of extension of what's good for the family in the traditional mafia sense?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. No, I thought that ultimately we were all, in my view, I thought we were ultimately all going to die. But it was going to be for the, you know, for the greater cause.
Right.
You know, I can.
But you were also willing to kill your own son.
Yeah.
Which was, I mean, that has sort of biblical ramifications also. But this guy, in theory, was so dedicated to the cause that, you know, a son who appeared to be less into the cause, given him the benefit of the doubt, or in the worst case scenario for you, actually working against you,
right,
that you would be willing to take him out,
yeah,
is an unusual circumstance. I mean, I don't think even the Sopranos,
right,
go that far.
Right, right. But I do know, I mean, I'm not going to pretend to know a whole lot about what goes on with the, I'm not even sure if the word is Muslim or Islamic, but that there is a term for things of that nature called mercy killings, where people, if they shame the family or if things happen that don't go according to their plan, have offed their children.
Really?
Yeah. I saw something recently on Forensic Files or something about that. But so it's not, I don't know if it's, I don't know how frequently that happens, but it made sense to me. I mean, you know, if we're trying to do something as grand as that, mm-hmm, and my son's going to be a rat, I'd take him out. You know what I mean?
Well, I mean, clearly there was an element of fanatic dedication that you know, just by virtue of, and I think the character alluded to it at one point, that, you know, we've been here for 10 years or something, and the whole idea was to blend in to this environment so that no one would ever think that this kind of threat would have emanated from you guys.
Right.
I think that was, but, you know, that's a huge sacrifice of time, of a chunk of your lives, ultimately your entire life was sacrificed. And that requires, you know, a degree of belief and dedication and fanaticism that I guess would enable you to do what for most people would be the unthinkable.
Right. A lot of those guys from that 9/11 thing, you know, they were the idea has always been that if you allow people to live in this country and see the kind of freedom that we have and the democracy and you know, just freedom to go to your own church and pray as you wish, that everything's going to be fine. People will understand that and they won't want to hate us. But that's not true. I mean, most of those people from the 9/11 thing were all people who many of them studied here and had lived here for years, and so apparently the whatever it is that that drives these people is greater than what we view as
the virtues of our society.
Yeah, yeah. Although, you know, just as a little aside, most of those guys before they went onto the plane, they went to a strip club the night before. Yeah.
Hello.
Hey.
Here's another thing. People would ask me. I had a couple of press people ask me when we were doing this red carpet thing. What it felt like to play, you know, a terrorist. And the truth is that, you know, that old adage that the old saying that one person's terrorist is another person's freedom fighter. And it's not a. I mean, obviously, I can't understand how somebody could hate this country to that degree.
Well, I think as an actor and as when you write a character like that, you obviously have to imbue him with a sense of self-belief and the idea that, I mean, you can't write Adolf Hitler as an evil character, mm-hmm. in the mind of the character. He's not evil.
Right, right.
He's doing what's necessary. He's, you know, all the justifications that accrue to that. And I think the same thing was true with your character. You have to approach it from the character's point of view. Mm-hmm. And from that point of view, he is carrying out a great and almost divine kind of mission. Mm-hmm. And the sacrifices that have to be made, both on your side and on the other side, are necessary. And you are going to be strong enough to be the conduit of that. That takes great, you know, strength. And I don't think that your character or any character like that is going to spend a lot of time beating himself up about the loss of innocent life. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think you said it. People, or Navia, Dina says it, your wife. You know, people die. This is war, and people die in war. And innocent people die in war. But from the point of view of these characters, I think they need to feel that they're doing what they need to do. And in the case of Baruz, I think he enabled us to start from that starting position to someone who has changed. And it might have been easier because he was a kid and maybe less immersed in the philosophy of the mission. But in a way, you know, he was almost the voice of innocence that became offended at the loss of innocent lives, whereas you and your wife had made their peace with that.
It's also, I think, more compelling to watch than to watch what you sometimes see as these one-dimensional villainous characters who you know, just want to destroy the world. These people had dimension. The Arise family,
mm-hmm.
and Jonathan being the extreme end of that spectrum. It was fun, man. I had a ball playing this. 10-15 minutes
ago, why? We have some new information. I'd like to share it with you. We found a curious connection to the terrorists.
What kind of connection?
Paul Raines.
My daughter's husband?
One of his companies is listed as the owner.
And you got to do some great scenes with Shora Dashlu, who is really a tremendous actor, also from House of Sand and Fog. Tremendous actor, and under some threat. You know, if she is a native Iranian, and if she, we were told that if she went back to Iran, she was subject to the most extreme penalty.
Mm.
Not as I understood it, because she played a terrorist here, but because she was an actor.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
And a female, so...
They don't take that acting thing very lightly over there, huh?
There are a number of actors that I would have agreed with their assessment, but...
Right.
In her case, no. She's really tremendous.
I saw House of Sand and Fog the night before I met her, because I knew that I was going to meet her and I wanted to become familiar with her work. I'd heard a lot about her. And I was a little bit intimidated because she did such a great job in that movie. I met her outside the trailer, and she's got this, she's like a little 12-year-old. She's got this little kind of giddy, kind of silly quality about her, and it was really disarming, and she was a lot of fun to work with. She's a good person. And Jonathan, of course, as well.
We have had our share of psycho women. I would say we get more flack about just writing psycho women. African didn't enter into it that much, although last year, the previous years, we had, Sherry Palmer, who I thought, you know, was played beautifully by Penny Johnson. I did think that Aisha Tyler did a fantastic job as Marianne here. She, you know, was able to, I think, ground her character in a level of intelligence that made you buy it, I think. She,
that's right,
obviously is quite attractive, and but also was, had that sense of power that was grounded in reality. I thought she did a great job.
Yeah, what was it? What's the name of that girl? The woman who played David's wife?
Penny Johnson.
Oh,
Gerald.
Man, she was great.
Yeah, she was.
I mean, so was Aisha, but I mean, this other one had such a range because she was on for so much longer.
Yeah,
she was fun to watch, boy.
Yeah, people love to hate her, which is, I think, the ultimate compliment for an actor. Actually, we're just next door to the set, so that may be somebody, you know, ripping up the script or banging on scenery in frustration or something.
You're pretty funny.
Thank you.
I do things around here. You can care less about me being falsely accused and tortured. You're beginning to feel squeezed out and you need allies. That's why you were so nice to me before.
We're facing a crisis today, Sarah. And our first priority is to deal with it successfully. Is that a problem for you?
Not at all. But after what I went through today, if you want my help, I need something too.
And what's that?
I want my arrest expunged. Not explained by an official letter in my file, expunged. And I want a promotion, 2 pay grades.
Done.
The character of Erin Driscoll, she was not a psycho woman. She was a strong woman in a very difficult situation coming into CTU, played by Alberta Watson. And in some respects, a kind of a bit of a thankless role, to the extent that she was supposed to be this very sort of bureaucratic, by-the-book type of character, and those are always difficult to play. One of the reasons that we gave her a personal story was exactly because we wanted to try to explore another side of that character, so that when you are watching her being, you know, quite by the numbers in terms of how she was running CTU, you also knew that there was another more emotional and more ultimately tragic side of her life that was going on at exactly the same time.
You know, this thankless stuff that I totally understand what you mean, because I've played enough of those kind of characters. But it's amazing how quickly you could turn on this show, because I felt the same way about the guy Chappelle. What was his first name?
Ryan
Chappelle. I felt at the first, I thought this guy is, you know, it's one of those guys comes in and, you know, barks orders and stuff. And mm-hmm. But when he had to take himself out, that scene, first of all, I never thought it was going to happen. I said, somehow, something's going to go on. But when he tried to take himself out and then Jack had to take him out, that was, again, probably, one of my favorite scenes there.
We've had success doing what the audience doesn't expect, but ultimately understands.
Jack, are the backup teams at the
Westmore? You know, the idea that Jack pulled the trigger on Chappelle is something that you feel like, oh, there's going to have to be some way out of it.
Right.
But when you ultimately recognize that there wasn't,
right,
you buy it, because if we had gotten him out of it, it would have felt, I think, a cheat. The audience would have felt, all right, here's another moment that, you know, you don't play out. Even at the end of last season, when Jack chopped the arm off of, you know, one of the other characters who had a bomb strapped to him or something like that. You know, I remember watching that scene in a sort of a focus group. And as soon as the audience saw that axe hanging on the wall, they went crazy because they knew what was going to happen.
Right.
But you still can't. It's like watching a train wreck.
Right.
You can't believe
right.
It's going to happen, but you're waiting to see it happen.
Right. It's kind of you paint these characters into a corner and they can't get out, and that's the only way out. And then when it happens, you realize that was the only way out.
Yeah.
And if you would have found some other way to get around it, it would have been, like you said, a cheat. Which is what happens all the time on most television.
The other advantage, I think, that we have, it's an advantage, it's also a burden to some extent, but the fact that this is obviously a serial and that storylines are not wrapped up in an episode, you have the opportunity to do that stuff, which, you know, most episodic television essentially are standalone episodes. They could air at any time, in any order, and so you are compelled by the restrictions of that form to do a lot more wrapping up
right.
than you might otherwise want to do. But in our format, you know, we don't. And It's the thing that keeps people coming back week in and week out. And in a time where there are so many other entertainment venues, you know, cable, DVDs, video, all the stuff that, you know, didn't exist when you and I started working together, it does make it even more gratifying that we've been able to hang on. And, you know, when we do things like shooting Marianne. I mean, ultimately, Marianne didn't get taken out by us. She got taken out by the bad guys.
Right.
I think people were actually surprised by that moment. I think you felt that she's in league with these guys, you know, and they're not going to do it. I think it was a moment where, somewhat akin to the fight that you had with Jack just before Beru shot your character, that you felt like she was going to be able to worm her way out of a tough situation with her own people.
Right.
And no, they blew her away.
My big question is, why is it that you don't have more copycat 24 formats? You would think that in a world where everybody's trying to, steal stuff. There's major espionage going on out here in Hollywood, and it seems like a no-brainer. The format.
Well,
is it?
I don't know that
do?
It's very hard to do. I mean, I think of when I think back on almost 20 years of doing this, being in this business, I think this is the hardest show I've ever worked on because each show is dependent on what came before and sets up what comes after. And that means that you have to plan and execute according to that plan. Otherwise, things just fall apart. It's just a lot tougher to do. And maybe because this is such a specific format of real time in every episode where every minute is accounted for, that if another show tried to do it, it would be such an obvious, duplication that they haven't done it.
Right.
I mean, even commercial time is accounted for when we, when we run these episodes. Mm-hmm. And I think the other thing that makes it challenging is that you can't, because it's real time, you can't fall back on the normal conventions of television or features for that matter, of jumping a character in time from one place to another.
Even stuff like slow motion, right?
I mean, we couldn't do that.
Yeah.
So, I mean, slow motion doesn't exist in real life. So I think it's probably one of the conceits that has kept all of these terrible events happening in the Los Angeles area, because we can't. We did send Jack to Mexico last season, but generally speaking, things have to take place in a relatively small geographic area.
Mm-hmm. Which ultimately, that's got to be good for production, right? I mean, a lot of times these places that you're shooting at, our locations are right around the corner.
Well, yeah, we tend to group them, and this is why we also, as you know, shoot two episodes at once, to take advantage of locations.
Right.
We appreciate your watching. We hope that you enjoyed it and that you got a little bit of insight into how the show is put together. It's always fun to talk about these things after you have worked on them and see the finished result. And as always, it's a pleasure to have Nestor here because not only is he a terrific actor, he's a great guy, and every time I see him, I'm reminded of how old I've gotten.
Yeah, I had a great time doing this, and a great time working with Stephen, and hope that we, if not in this venue, some other one, we can have the opportunity to do that again. And I'd like to thank the audience for watching and being such huge fans of the show, and I hope they continue to do that.